DiscerningHearts.com presents Beginning to Pray with Dr. Anthony Lillis. Dr. Lillis is an associate professor and the academic dean of St. John's Seminary in Camarillo, California, as well as the academic advisor for the St. Juan Diego House of Priestly Formation for the Archdiocese of Los Angeles. Through the years, clergy, seminarians, religious, and lay faithful have benefited from his lectures and retreat conferences on the Carmelite Doctors of the Church and the writings of St. Elizabeth of the Trinity. He is the author of Hidden Mountain's Secret Garden, a theological contemplation of prayer, as well as numerous other books focused on the spiritual life. In this series of conversations with Dr. Lillis, we focus on Doctor of the Church, St. Teresa of Avila, and her great spiritual masterwork, The Interior Castle. Beginning to Pray with Dr. Anthony Lillis. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. Anthony, thank you so much for joining me again.
It's wonderful to be with you, Chris. I'm really excited about what we're about to talk about. Book 6 of The Interior Castle. We're at chapter 4, and I've been looking forward to our conversation.
We are really diving deep into the heart of Teresa of Avila, aren't we?
We're in the inner dwelling places of the castle. When we were talking earlier in earlier shows about the first and second and third dwelling places, those are kind of like on the periphery, but now we're really deep into the heart.
It's so interesting in that first paragraph of the fourth chapter of the Sixth Mansion, where she mentions that you have to have courage, courage for union with a Lord so great it may take him for her spouse. Isn't that interesting? You have to have courage.
It's like that by analogy with any relationship that's really important. You know, I think today we live at a time where there's a lack of courage when it comes to meaningful relationships. I'm talking in particular, we have a lot of young people who are living together and they're afraid to get married. If you ask them, you know, why don't you want to get married? They're afraid of what might go wrong if they do get married, that they won't be able to be faithful, or they're afraid of being stuck with the other person and that kind of thing. And that fear has robbed them, and the fear is a lack of courage. To have courage means to have heart. And if you don't have heart, you don't have what it takes to stick with something, come what come may. And that's what they're concerned about. They're not so sure that they or the person they're living with has the heart that's needed for a lifetime commitment. And so they enter into these kind of tentative arrangements for the human person that they're not really good for us. We're made for something permanent, and we're made for a kind of greatness. And a lifetime of faithful love begins to unfold the greatness of humanity. Jesus, in these higher levels of prayer, has asked for the soul's hand. And the soul right now in the Sixth Mansion is being waken up by Jesus. He's waking up the soul. So, and part of waking up the soul is helping it find the courage it needs for an even deeper commitment, an even more meaningful intimacy with the Lord, one that is marked by a fruitful fidelity, very close to what marriage is. And in fact, you could say that marriage is kind of a shadow of what Jesus is promising the soul as he wakes her up. But for Jesus to do his work on our side, we need to have the courage, the resolve, the determination, the readiness to respond. And we can't be half-hearted about it. We need to be willing to go all the way. And above all, this means the courage, the heart, to trust God, come what come may.
It's fascinating, this first paragraph. Not only she talks about having courage, but she also begins to shed some light on an experience I think is quite fascinating. It's the nature of raptures that the soul might experience. And I just have to say, as a woman, I'm kind of hard on my own sex. And when she said, I'm speaking of genuine raptures, not fancies that come from women's weakness, which so often occur nowadays. And I had a laugh because I thought, well, what's old is new again. Because, and I convict myself too. I mean, it's kind of her frankness about this, her practicality is just so refreshing. I think that's why she's such a joy to read.
Sure. And for somebody who is a little bit more sensitive and tender, there's strengths with that. You know, you're able to respond to what's going on in the moment precisely because you are tender and sensitive to what's going on. But you can also be easily overcome in the moment. And that's true. Women, men too, though. St. John of the Cross, you know, he was a poet. And so he was very sensitive to things that were going on. And that's why the Lord kind of needed to toughen him up by throwing him in prison for a little while. And that actually prepared him for deeper and more sustained kinds of union. So it's what she's talking about, though, and what's kind of key is we live at a time today where there's kind of like a gluttony or lust for religious experience, including this kind of rapture. And the problem, if we're not a little bit more sober about the way we're approaching experiences in prayer, it's easy for us to self-manufacture something that is not God. And so Teresa's a realist, and she's going to say self-manufacturing a state of consciousness or a psychic state isn't really going to help you with your union with God. In fact, your ability to self-manufacture a psychic state says more about the weakness of your nature than it does about what God's actually doing in your heart. And so she's inviting people to step back and to be a little bit more strong, to have a little bit more heart in their relationship with the Lord, and not to seek for things in an inordinate way. We should seek the Lord with all our might, with all our strength, with our whole soul. Every heartbeat should yearn for the Lord. Last time we spoke, we talked about locution. If he gives you an inner word, what a beautiful thing, a gift to have. If he doesn't, you don't need it. If he gives you a rapture and some sort of vision in this rapture, well, praise him for that. That's a wonderful gift. In one sense, a little bit ordinary from the standpoint of it's not something that you've received that's beyond the scope of the baptismal grace that you've received. But you don't need it to be enraptured in order to have union with God. God might lead you in a totally different way. And so being sober, rooted in yourself, and not getting caught up in kind of gluttonously devouring spiritual experiences is a must. If you are oriented towards trying to acquire spiritual experiences in prayer, you will always go off track every single time.
I think that's, as you use the term sobering, we need to be sober about this stuff. Even St. Paul, in a way, says don't become a drunkard, because you never know. And we can get drunk on a desire to consume those kind of experiences. Am I correct?
That's right. If you look at St. Paul's writings, in fact, he will describe raptured, being enraptured into the highest heaven. And what did he see there? I mean, it's amazing. But he hardly describes it. In fact, in his letters, there's no description of what he saw or experienced in the highest heaven. What does he spend most of his time describing? After he talks about that experience, he says, but I will not boast about this. Instead, I will boast about, and what he boasts about, are all the failures and all the unjust persecution and all the terrible tragedies and hardships and trials, things that really cost him that were painful in his life. These were the things that he boasted about. And why does he boast about those things? Because in his weakness, that's where the power of God is most revealed. In fact, he even talks about a thorn in his flesh that he begged to be removed 3 times. And God told him, he said, you know, my strength, God did not remove the thorn from his flesh. And he described it as a demon that tormented him. And God said, I'm not going to remove this because My strength is being brought to perfection in your weakness. And so as Christians, what we honor and what we hold up as the greatest union with God is our ability to follow in the footsteps of our crucified master. If the Lord gives you a rapture and an intellectual vision in the rapture, thank him for that. If he gives you an interior word, a locution, thank him for that. You needed that because through that he's communicated something to you. But why did he communicate what he communicated to you? Why did you need it? Because without it, you wouldn't be able to make progress on the way to the cross. Union with God is always, always, always a progress in union with Jesus and his sufferings on the cross. And any other kind of union that somebody speaks about that avoids the cross, it's simply not Christian. Jesus said, unless you will deny yourself, pick up your cross and follow me, you cannot be my disciple. And Teresa's very aware of that. And so when she's talking about having courage in this stage, she means specifically a kind of courage to be surrendered to whatever the Lord wants to give you, whenever and however he wants to give it to you. But she's also talking about the courage you need to make progress by way of the cross, because you're not, what gets communicated to you isn't a way around the cross or beyond the cross. What gets communicated to you is a wisdom and truth you need so that you can follow the way of the cross.
As you describe it, how ultimately our journey leads us to the foot of the cross and maybe even to experience that ourselves in a very real way through, with, and in him, we really are, we experience that, don't we, in some way every time we go to Mass. Isn't that the apex of the spiritual journey, is we celebrate that every time we go to Mass?
That's right. And that's, you know, right now, while we're doing this recording, Catholics all over the world are deprived of the grace of being able to participate in the Eucharistic liturgy by being physically present in the church. Fortunately, because of technology, so many of us have access to video streams and so forth. You're removed from the action of the priest by not being able to be physically present to what's going on. The sacramental ministry and the liturgical signs are things that are meant to be experienced not only in real time, but actually, rather than simply, you know, virtually and electronically. The actual experience in an electronic format is diminished. But at the same time, the reality of what's playing out, wherever Father is celebrating Mass, by an act of faith, I can unite myself to that. And if the electronic media helps me do that, all the better for it. If it distracts me, then I can turn it off. I don't need it to participate in the Mass. I'm thinking right now, I think it was in Ethiopia, I heard a description about Christians walking for hours so they could sit on the outside of a church. They weren't able to enter in, but they were sitting on the outside of the church while waiting for hours for the Eucharistic liturgy to take place. And then the Eucharistic liturgy would take place, but they were not on the inside of the church being able to see or hear very much of anything at all. They were on the outside, and yet on the outside of the church, they were making all the gestures as if they were in the inside of the church. They were following the liturgy the best they could. Just to be near the church, to have their hands on the wall, was for them the way they participated in the liturgy. They put their whole minds and hearts into it. Well, I think we're called to do that today. When Teresa of Avila is inviting us into the inner chambers of the heart, the inner dwelling places of this beautiful spiritual castle that she's unpacked for us with such astonishing detail, she's inviting us to draw close to the Eucharistic Lord. He is the light of the world. He's the light of our souls. In the Mass, that great work that he did for us on the cross is being renewed and extended into space and time for us. And if we join ourselves spiritually to that, that is the most surefire and most powerful means to draw as close and as intimate to the Lord as we possibly can. And so it's not either mental prayer or liturgical prayer. In order to enter into the Mass, whether you can be physically present there or not, you need to mentally, in your heart, in your mind, you need to mentally make yourself present to it by faith. And when you do, then your ability to receive a spiritual communion, all the graces that you could have received had you been at Mass and been able to receive communion, you can do that spiritually by asking Jesus for those graces, even though you're not at Mass. And Jesus will give you all the graces that he intends for you to have. All those Eucharistic graces will be poured into your soul because you've drawn close to him by this act of faith.
It must be so frustrating for a soul that would experience something like this and not be able to communicate it as effectively as you wish you could, especially to maybe a spiritual director or a confessor.
There's some frustration, there's some anxiety. These souls feel, although they are so grateful for the Lord and they're so on fire with his love, they also feel misunderstood and extremely alone at the same time. And Teresa says in the beginning, when you kind of feel that way and you're complaining that people misunderstand you and even persecute you for your experiences, it is a little bit upsetting for such a soul because they're not used to this. And she said, well, there's a little the reason why this disturbs you so much is there's a little bit of imperfection still going on. But the love of God's going to take care of that. So you just need to trust him and not get carried away by what other people think or don't think, whether they understand or don't understand. God has brought you into a place that that others don't normally get to go. And because you've gone there, you've been entrusted with something. And because no one else has been entrusted with anything like it, of course they're not going to understand. And you need to be patient with them, and you need to be patient with God who loves you this much. And so all of this is going on. The deeper question is, if this knowledge, it, on one hand, frustrates you because you can't quite share it, nobody really understands it, and they misunderstand you, why would God give you this kind of knowledge, or why would he baptize your intellect with images that are so astounding, even when you try to describe them to other people, they just can't get it? Why does he do this? And we've talked about this a little bit earlier, but just to go back to it, he's communicated to you truths and love that you need for a deeper and more intimate, more meaningful relationship with him. And without the truth, without the love that's been entrusted to you, you won't be able to make progress. So he's given it to you through this means. And because he wants you for himself. And even though he knows it's going to cost you a little bit, because he wants you for himself so much, and he knows the desires in your heart that you want him for yourself so much, he knows that the discomfort of feeling alone and misunderstood and falsely judged, he knows that discomfort is something that ultimately you will gladly suffer for his sake as you make progress into deeper and deeper union with him.
As we go through this particular mansion in this chapter 4, what else should we be aware of? She's describing some incredible things.
The two tendencies that people can have when we engage this kind of literature is they can want the experiences so much that they begin to self-manufacture them. And so people are sometimes so exuberant about where they're at the spiritual life and whether or not they're having these experiences or not, they quickly put themselves in the sixth and seventh mansions. And that's not the reason why she's writing this. A certain kind of sobriety is called for, and courage to face yourself and where you're really at. You know, obviously, if you're struggling with habitual sin, you're probably not in the sixth mansion. That's one set of problems. The other set of problem is the opposite. I've seen this a lot too, and that is somebody will read this and just say, well, what's the point of studying this at all? I will never get there, and nobody I know will ever get there. So why write or talk about these things? Why are they even remotely important to consider, since, you know, I will always be in the first three dwelling places and so six. I mean, I'm never going to be enraptured and have intellectual visions. I mean, forget about it. That kind of despairing attitude on one hand. One attitude is rash, and the other one is despairing. And Teresa, in her teaching, she's trying to help souls not be rash, to kind of be real about themselves and the fact that you can self-manufacture stuff. So you need to desire Jesus more than you desire the experiences. On the other hand, she doesn't want us to be despairing or fearful about this. You know, not too long ago, there was a priest who was killed in northern France. He was martyred in the church by some young religious zealots. And he was martyred because he stood up to them about the truth of Jesus. And they were kind of drunk on religious hatred. And he just simply spoke the sober truth. And then he was martyred. One of his priest friends, also from France, said, you know, once I was in a conversation with Father, and there were a couple of us bantering back and forth, and we talked about, you know, how we'll never be saints. And Father looked at us and said, do not say that sanctity is something not for me. It's closer to you than you think. Now, who would have known in that little conversation that that priest was going later on be martyred and therefore is a saint? But so it is with us. Do not say that these experiences are something that you'll never be able to have. Teresa's telling us about these things to invite us to be more generous to Jesus and more surrendered, more open, to encourage us to renew our devotion, to renew our dedication to the Lord, because there's something worthwhile. Intimacy with the Lord is not a boring excursion into, you know, a banal and meaningless life. Devotion to the Lord, intimacy with Him, opens up an existence so meaningful, it's heartbreakingly beautiful and joyful and jubilant and filled with glory and intimacy and greatness. We're called to greatness, and she's trying to help us see that we're called to greatness. And she doesn't want us to be rash and presume that we just get there because we wish we were there. On the other hand, she really wants us to reach for this. Reach out for and let God communicate Himself to you in new ways by being dedicated to Him in your prayer. He does operate and He does come to you and He does communicate the most beautiful and wonderful things for you. And when He does, it's just what you need so that you can accomplish His will in your life. And not to seek this, not to seek this intimacy with the Lord, not to seek that which He yearns to give us. That would be one of the greatest tragedies that a person's life could become. And so this sentiment lives behind all her writings, but perhaps this chapter in particular. One more note I would say kind of goes with this to be aware of is somebody could say, okay, but all this rapture stuff and all this is so extra scriptural and everything. You know, you're building these kind of mystical sandcastles that don't really exist in our faith. And she's gotten caught up in her imagination, and it's esoteric and it's not so real. Well, I would contradict that. Jesus revealed Himself in the New Testament as the bridegroom. And the image that He uses for us in His parables, we are virgin brides. As a man, that's a little bit harder for me to get my imagination around, but in His parables, that's the position He invites me to place myself. Well, that imagery of bridegroom and bride, it's taken up by St. Paul. And St. Paul, the book of Ephesians, I believe it's in chapter 5, Mm-hmm. Around verse 26 or so, Jesus is the one who laid down his life for the church. And this is what's foreshadowed in marriage. This is the great mystery. So the idea of Jesus as bridegroom is not a secondary mystery or something optional that you can believe or not believe. It is, St. Paul says, the great mystery. And where else do we learn about the great mystery? Where did St. John get the language of the bride and the bridegroom and develop that in his Gospels? And why is it so much a powerful part of the book of Revelations? Where did that come from? Well, in the Old Testament, we have the Song of Songs. And not only Teresa, but John of the Cross saw the connection of the Song of Songs with the journey that souls go through on their way to union with God. They saw this. And even today, what we were talking about in the Song of Songs, there are different places in those that beautiful poem between the soul and God. There are places where the soul complains about people misunderstanding and mistreating it. And why was that soul misunderstood and mistreated? Because it woke up to the bridegroom, and because the bridegroom had revealed something to her that nobody else could really understand. So these experiences, and so the bride complains to the bridegroom, and he comes and consoles her himself. These experiences that I'm sharing with you, these are not extra biblical experiences or experiences only for the few and the elite in the Catholic Church. These are experiences that baptism has inducted us into, and they're part of the living experience of the church. And while I myself may never have a rapture or an intellectual vision, I can yearn for the intimacy with the Lord that is behind that vision. And I can yearn for that union and friendship with him that vision speaks to, because in heaven, that will be my greatest possession. She's opening up for us a vision of heaven, not far away from us, but a vision of heaven that is right in us if we turn our thoughts to him who made us and surrender everything to him.
You've been listening to Beginning to Pray with Dr. Anthony Lillis. To hear and or to download this conversation, along with hundreds of other spiritual formation programs, visit discerninghearts.com, or you can find it within the free Discerning Hearts app and on other numerous streaming platforms. This has been a production of Discerning Hearts. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. We hope that if this program has been helpful for you, that you will first pray for our mission, which is to offer authentic and rock-solid spiritual formation programs freely to souls around the world. And if you feel us worthy, please consider a charitable donation, which is fully tax-deductible, to help support our efforts. But most of all, we hope that you will tell a friend about discerninghearts.com and join us next time for Beginning to Pray with Dr. Anthony Lillis.